Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. 26 Answers to 26 Reasons is a live recording of a midweek class conducted by Pastor Lancaster in 2009 to answer common anti-missionary objections to the gospel. The class purchased and used Asher Norman's book, 26 Reasons Why Jews Don't Believe in Jesus, as a textbook for discussion. This book is available from Feldheim Publishers, copyright 2007. You can join the class by listening along as we defend Messianic Judaism and the claims of the New Testament. To support Beth Emanuel in this important work, click on the Support tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
Reason number 22 is resurrection narratives in the Gospel, so it's very apropos seasonally, since we are now just a few days away from Passover. So this is kind of nice. It worked out nicely to be studying these resurrection texts now. It wasn't by design, but worked out well. Not my design. So reason number 22 that Jews don't believe in Jesus is that the resurrection accounts, those are the resurrection accounts found in the four Gospels, are deeply conflicted. And they are. Make no mistake, they are. And part of what we've done in the last couple of weeks is really worked hard in trying to come to an understanding of what the Gospels are and what they, how they came into being and what they're designed to do, so that we have a little better understanding of what they're not designed to do. So that's why we've been, you know, beating that drum so hard, is really in anticipation of things like this particular reason, reason number 22. So Asher Norman says in the introduction to this chapter, he says, Christianity stands or falls on the veracity and credibility of the so-called resurrection accounts in the Bible. So that means that if these resurrection accounts are found are fallible, if they're not reliable, trustworthy, and then by inference, we cannot be certain that a resurrection actually occurred, then we're out of business. And that's true, we really are. We're out of business. At that point, we may step back to Jesus was a great teacher. He was a great teacher of Torah, a rabbi. And you might even pull in prophet, because there are, as we have seen, there are fulfilled prophecies from his mouth. But in terms of his claim for to be Messiah, we would have to say, well, we don't have the evidence there. Why is that? As we've learned previously in this class, because the Messianic redemption has not yet occurred. The final redemption hasn't yet occurred. And so we are basing everything in our faith, everything hinges on the resurrection. If he was raised, here's the reasoning, just so you know why you believe what you believe. Here's the reasoning. The man made certain claims. He made claims to be the Messiah of Israel, the promised, predicted son of David, the king of Israel, who will bring about the final redemption. So he made these claims, but he hasn't made good on the claims yet. However, the fact that he was raised, that God raised him from the dead, verifies his testimony. Because if you think about it, let's say that he was just a really righteous guy, really righteous man, who thought he was the Messiah, mistakenly, but he actually wasn't the Messiah. And God says, well, I don't think it was fair that he died. I'm going to resurrect him from the dead. That wouldn't be a good plan on God's part. Because by resurrecting him from the dead, as he had predicted would happen, it seems to add credibility and veracity to everything he claimed about himself. Yes? So, the resurrection is the key piece of Christian confession and faith. If we take away the resurrection, and sometimes I hear liberal Christians talk about how the resurrection is actually, you know, it's not a literal resurrection. It's more the Spirit of Christ is, you know, was raised and energized his followers and this sort of thing, which is very nice and kind of hocus-pocus warm feelings. But if that were the case, then this is just, as Paul says in Corinthians, if Messiah is not raised, we are to be pitied above all men. Why does he say that? Well, because we're spending all of our time, we're investing all of our time and energy in pursuit of Yeshua of Nazareth. And more than that, we are, you know, we're denying ourselves, taking up his cross, following after him, you know, making sacrifices for naught if he's not resurrected. So it's really important that we have confidence in the resurrection. So this is really a pretty important reason number 22. The resurrection accounts are deeply conflicted. And like I said, they are. They are deeply conflicted on a detail level. And he gave us 25 such examples of conflicts that he finds in these resurrection accounts. It's a lot of text to look up. And I'm not exactly sure how to do that best, what the best plan is for that. I pulled out my A.T. Robertson's Harmony of the Gospels to maybe give us a little, you know, where it lays out all four Gospels in parallel columns that will maybe save us a little bit of flipping back and forth time. And we'll just see how it goes. I get started with the first one, which is a classic. The first one is, on which day was Jesus crucified? Now, you may or may not be aware of this classic contradiction in the gospel text, but there is certainly a contradiction as to which day the crucifixion occurred on. So we find in the Gospel of John, and here are your texts, John 13:1, which says, well, let's see what it says. John 13:1. Is going to bring us into that Last Supper, which is never called a Seder. It's never called a Passover Seder in John. John 13:1 says, "Now before the feast of Passover, Jesus, knowing the hour he had come, that he would depart out of his world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end, and during supper, the devil..." And so here we are, we're in supper, it's a supper meal, it's before the feast of Passover, all right? And just to make sure, to seal the deal here, if you flip over to John 18, and verse 28, it says, "Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early, and they themselves did not enter," this is the priests, "did not enter into the praetorium, so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover." Meaning that the Passover festival was about to happen, but they had not yet had the Seder. So the Seder is that night, which makes the event that we're reading about here as he's being led into the praetorium, that puts that event on Nisan 14, the 14th day of the month of Nisan, which is Passover proper, meaning the day that the lamb, that Israel was to take a lamb and slaughter it in the temple and roast it. That night would be Seder night, the 15th of Nisan, beginning at sunset, all right? And everybody would eat their Seders that night. Okay, so that is John. All of the synoptics disagree with John. And you might say, well, that's a, you know, three against one. We should go with the synoptics. But the synoptics, remember, are all, you know, seeing as one. That's what synoptic means. The synoptics are actually one testimony. Even though there's three versions of them, they're coming from one mother text, that is the Gospel of Mark. So if we look at Mark chapter 14, for example, and I guess he's suggesting we go to verse 17. Well, let's try 14, okay? Verse 14. All right. "The teacher says, 'Where is the guest room in which I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' And he himself will show you a large upper room furnished and ready prepared for us there. The disciples went out and came to the city and found it just as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover." So what does it mean, they prepared the Passover? That would be to slaughter a lamb on the day of Passover, on the 14th of Nisan. And that night, it says in verse 17, "When it was evening," so now what day is it? It's the 15th, right? "He came with the 12, and as they were reclining at the table and eating, Jesus said, 'Truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me.' And here we are at the last Seder. And so we could look at the text, for example, we could go to, you know, if there's any doubt that it's Passover, Luke chapter 22 begins with, "Now the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is called the Passover, was approaching." And then he goes and prepare the Passover, as we read in Mark. Verse 15, he said to them, "I have earnestly desired to eat this Pesach, this Passover, with you before I suffer, for I say to you, I shall never again eat it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God." All right, so synoptics are unanimous in that the crucifixion then would come the next day, of course, the next morning. So it's the 15th of Nisan. So you have a discrepancy between John and the synoptics. And this discrepancy on a literal reading of the text is irreconcilable. And this is what Asher Norman says. A monumental irreconcilable discrepancy. And he's right. He's right on the money there. This is, and I know because I've spent many, 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 many long hours trying to reconcile this and written extensively about it, and I am not the first. People have been trying to reconcile this discrepancy since the Gospel of John first hit the press, I think. It's a problem. It's a problem. What do you do with it? Well, one of the things that we do with it is we harmonize. Like I've said before, you know, if these were sources in the Talmud if we had a Gemara on it and the sages were arguing about it, say in the 4th century, and they said, well, John says this, Matthew, Mark, and Luke say that, they'd say, well, here's how it happened, and they would come up with some sort of harmonization of the text, and that's what I like to do. I like to come up with these harmonizations. But inevitably, and there's dozens of these. I mean, there are so many different explanations for how this goes down. Inevitably, you need to do some sort of violence to something in the gospel narratives in order to achieve your harmonization. That's all right. That's just part of the game. So here's what I like to do. I mean, just so you know what I like to do, but you can take it or leave it. I like to say that John's right and the synoptics are wrong. That John is right, the synoptics are wrong, but the synoptics remember that the Master eagerly desired to eat his Passover with his disciples before he suffered. Therefore, he had a Passover before Passover with his disciples, which is not a mitzvah. But neither is it a sin, you know. And that's why John, who as an eyewitness, perhaps, as one strand of eyewitness testimony, never calls it a Seder. That's how I reconcile it. I was pleased to see that that's how Rabbi Lichtenstein also reconciles it. But to get there, you have to. You have to take some issue with the synoptic account, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But you need to be comfortable with it. And you need to be able to... What I have found in the Messianic movement in general is that people adopt one interpretation, one position on this, and they say, this is the way it went down. And it's not just the Messianic movement. Marvin could probably tell you, worldwide, Church of God had a very tight interpretation. They had this figured out exactly the way it went down. And then they own this, and it's like anybody who doesn't take this chronological interpretation is, a heretic. And he's like, you know. Right. This becomes a major, major point of contention between believers, which... it should not be. If it was so important to God that we would really get heated about it and angry with each other about it, then he should not have given us a discrepancy in the Gospels. I'm thinking that the exact timing of the events might not be as critical as we make them out to be. Another possibility is And this does not work for a variety of reasons, but it's something that you'll commonly bump into, is that our master, at least on this occasion, adopted the Essene reckoning. The Essenes followed a solar calendar, and so it was, you know, they're a sectarian group that had pulled out of the rest of Judaism. That's why they're down by the Dead Sea. They followed a solar reckoning of the calendar, so their Passover Seder was consistently, I believe, on Wednesday night. It would be, I think it's either Tuesday night or Wednesday. I can't remember exactly how it works out. But so then you end up, you know, with, well, perhaps Yeshua was following the Essene tradition, at least in this instance. But this has a couple of problems. First of all, it doesn't satisfy the lamb issue because the Essenes weren't running the temple. In fact, they had specifically pulled out of the temple. You still couldn't get a Passover lamb. And secondly, then you have this, you know, a couple extra days to account for between the Seder and the crucifixion. Whereas all the Gospels are at least unanimous on this point that the night of that meal, the Last Supper or Last Seder, is the eve of his crucifixion. And the Essene theory, you know, with the Essene theory, you have to jettison that. I think with the worldwide theory, you also have to jettison that. You have to figure in some extra days in there. I don't recall. Anyway, what's the point? We have a discrepancy. Score one.
Wait, I thought I heard you say one time, maybe it wasn't you, that if a person couldn't be at the Passover Seder, they could do it the night before.
Right.
The whole fast.
Messianics teach that all the time, but it's not true.
Oh, really? Oh.
Right. That there's a Jewish tradition that says if you couldn't be at the Passover Seder, you could have it the night before. Not true. Not true. In fact, the Torah specifically provides legislation for what will happen if you can't make it to a Seder. You have it a month later. Yeah. So, right. And part of the problem is like sorting through all of the apocrypha and all of the, I like to call it balderdash, that gets, you know, attached by people who will tell you what Jewish tradition says. You know, for example, my favorite is the folded napkin. Do you know the folded napkin?
Yes.
Some of you have heard of the folded napkin. Well, there's a Jewish tradition that if you enjoyed the meal, but you were going to be back or something like this, you would fold the napkin and set it in a certain place at the table or something like that. So you've heard of that one. It also comes out as there's a tradition that when a carpenter was working on a job, if he wasn't finished and he was going to return to finish the job, or no, when the job was finished, he would let the person who he's building for know by taking off his headpiece and folding it and leaving it at the job site. You'll hear various versions of this. And all of this is to say that then when John went in the tomb and he saw the folded napkin, the folded kerchief, which is the King James version, you know, the napkin, King James translation anyway, for that, a headcloth is actually what it is. In the tomb, then he knew, and people get a real blessing out of this, but it's complete, it's bunk. And there's a lot of that.
We just go from one bunk.
Oh, yeah, one bunk to the next bunk. Oh, maybe you've heard this one. You've heard that at the triumphal entry, what actually happened is that the high priest goes out and gets his lamb that is going to be his sacrificial lamb on the 10th day of Nisan, and he leads it into the city, and the people lay palms before that lamb, and they lay their coats before it, and they say, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." And Yeshua came in right after that lamb, thereby saying, "I am the Passover lamb." If you might have heard that. That's very popular.
That's one of the first things.
Right. That was one of the first things I heard. I even thought, oh, that's so fabulous. I was so blessed by that.
Yeah.
Right, and so this was like maybe my first week in the Messianic movement or something. I don't know. So I wrote an article about this, like, you know, a newsletter type of article, and sent it out to my family and friends and everybody in our congregation. You know, with this teaching. You know, this is my first experience with this kind of thing, and that got picked up and quoted in various books and this sort of thing. And
you had to be a rabbi.
writer.
Right, and then I later found out, no, that's not true. That was all made up. So you got to be careful with, especially careful with people who call themselves Hebrew roots teachers and this sort of thing.
What would explain, just then, because my whole thought was like, that's why everyone was gathered there. What brought the gathering there? Just because of the prayers that were going on?
No. Oh, that's a great question. I mean, there is real evidence. I mean, there's a real answer to these questions. That's a great question. But in Philo and Josephus and in the Talmud, we read about the great influx of pilgrims coming into the city to keep the festival of Passover. And so for days before the festival, it says that the roads to Jerusalem filled with people like rivers of people flowing into the city. And they would be singing, as the songs of ascent, I believe. But they would be singing as they came into the city. And so as the master is entering, there are people everywhere. And these are people also from the Galilee who would have, you know, people who have come up from the Galilee who have seen him. He's been working among them. Many of them, you know, 4,000 he fed, 5,000 he fed, you know. So they're excited. They're ecstatic that he's here, you know, that this is, and he's coming out publicly and he's riding on a donkey, just like it says in Zechariah. This is it, you know. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's enough.
Yeah, that's enough.
Mm-hmm. What goes along with inspiration? Perfection?
Yes, that's the question. Because inspiration and infallible are two different things. Okay, inspiration means spirit-breathed. Okay, infallible, you know, I testify that the Word of God is infallible. First of all, in its original manuscripts. Infallible. But infallible, morally, ethically, spiritually, in terms of what it is that God is communicating or intends to communicate, that's what's infallible. It might not be infallible on a detail that we want to draw out of it. So I have a little loosey-goosey interpretation of infallibility, I guess, but I don't see how you could sit through 26 reasons, a 26 reasons class, and not have your infallibility shaken a little bit. So, anyway, I hope that nobody comes out of this 26 Reasons class and saying, well, you know, that Asher Norman guy was right, I guess. You know, but
it makes a lot of sense.
Sometimes.
All right. So, we're going to leave that one. Because I spent a lot of time trying to reconcile this discrepancy. And at a certain point, not too long ago, really, maybe in the last 5 years or so, maybe I got tired or something, I don't know, but I just grew weary with arguing with the Bible, with like trying to impose my will on the text. It's kind of changed the way I deal with this stuff. So, number two, at what time did it happen? This is consistent in the synoptics. He gives us the Mark reference. The crucifixion happened at 9. The sun was darkened at noon. The master breathed his last at 3. Now, it doesn't say 9 a.m. It says the third hour, the sixth hour, the ninth hour, right? However, in John 19, if you want to look it up, you can see it. It says he was crucified at the sixth hour, the sixth hour. Okay, so that's a three-hour discrepancy in terms of when did the crucifixion actually happen. One says the third hour, or the synoptics say the third hour, John says the sixth hour.
About
the sixth hour. Is the ninth hour about, or is the third hour about the sixth hour?
No, but the third hour could be a little later, so if we meet in the middle.
I don't know.
So
meet in the middle.
I've been thinking about time. When
you meet in the middle. Maybe that's the time of year they set the clocks back, and that's right. All right. I don't know the answer to this one either.
Maybe it took 3 hours.
I have taught on it. I can tell you my theory, and because I'm sure that's what I taught when I taught on it. Although I don't remember, and that might have been why I was still fighting with the Bible. Yeah. Yeah. So I taught on it. What would I have taught? I would have. This is how I remember teaching on it, and I believe this is what I have in Torah Club, is that it's just a suggestion because we really don't know, and I don't think this holds up consistently across the rest of the Gospel of John, but it's possible that John uses Roman reckoning here instead of Jewish reckoning of time, and that perhaps the sixth hour by Roman reckoning begins being counted, say, at... If the Roman reckoning starts at midnight, the sixth hour is 6 a.m.
He said this at the sunrise.
See, we're already in trouble.
What if he's flabbergasted that he's being killed and can't remember what time it is?
What if they count the crucifixion?
I would be confused
when he was carrying the cross and when he got flogged as being the beginning of it.
Hey, it darkened at that time.
That would be later.
Okay, so listen to this. This actually works then. The verse doesn't say he was crucified at that hour. It says, now it was the day of preparation for the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, Pilate says, behold your king. So they cried out, away with him. So this is the presentation. So you could easily factor in an additional 3 hours until the actual crucifixion. Right.
But they're not saying... That pushes it off the other direction.
No. It depends on if the synoptist is saying that
Roman. Yes, if we're following the Roman
Roman reckoning,
then we have... Now, it seems like that's a little early to have Pilate up in the morning, but maybe not. I don't know.
Well, he could have pushed it because Passover was happening that night.
Maybe he was up all night.
So he was crying.
His wife was having nightmares. Couldn't sleep. He does, yes. This is we're asking when was he actually crucified? Because the synoptics are so emphatic on that point that it was at the third hour. But John has him standing, behold the man at the sixth hour. So there is a discrepancy here, but this is a discrepancy which could be accounted for by saying there are different reckonings of time. All right.
Not as bad as the first one.
Not an irreconcilable discrepancy. Who carried the cross? John says it was the master, whereas in Mark... and the synoptics, it's Simon of Cyrene that carries the cross for him. Couldn't it have been both? And in fact, according to the Stations of the Cross, it is both. It is both. And now, all of you probably know the scene where the master stumbles under the weight of the cross. And at that time, they conscript a passerby, Simon of Cyrene. Right. Did you know that nowhere in the Gospels does it tell us about him stumbling under the weight of the cross? That is something that comes to us through Christian tradition, but it's a strong tradition. The Stations of the Cross are an extremely old, strong Christian tradition. Does he? He stumbles more than once in the Stations? See? We need to get up on our own traditions.
I had to do that every day.
So the Simon of Cyrene thing is interesting though, because I just wanted to show you something about Simon of Cyrene. If you could turn to Mark 15. This is actually, the Simon of Cyrene thing is actually a really important evidence of the veracity of this story. Here's what it says. 15:21, they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene. So this Simon of Cyrene is a Jewish guy, and he's coming up to keep Passover. The father of Alexander and Rufus to bear his cross. And then they brought him to the place of skull. First of all, you have to feel sorry for Simon of Cyrene, because he was going up to keep Passover And this is Roman law that you can conscript someone to carry. And so they conscripted him to carry. And now he's like carrying an execution stake, which probably, you know, has been used before. So he is ritually defiled and can't keep the Passover that night. Right. So you got to feel sorry for Simon and Cyrene, particularly if he came all the way from Cyrene for this event. Cyrene is opposite Italy on the African coast. So it would be a long journey that he made for Passover. But listen to this. This is the more important part. Simon of Cyrene is the father of Alexander and Rufus. Who's Alexander and Rufus?
The ones who judged him earlier?
No, you don't know who Alexander and Rufus is, and neither do I, but the people that read Mark knew Alexander and Rufus. The people that Mark was writing the Gospel of Mark for, they knew Alexander and Rufus. This is, so it's a living link, a living testimony link. Now we find out a little bit more about Alexander and Rufus because two things. First of all, Alexander's, the ossuary has been found. Alexander of Cyrene. His ossuary is found in a Jerusalem tomb. And Rufus, Paul greets in Rome. That's right. Paul sends greetings to Rufus. So these were people that were believers and known in the believing community. And they were able to say, you know, it was our father that carried the master's cross. And why is this so important? Because when we talk about the resurrection, the early believers didn't rely on these gospels for the resurrection and their faith in the resurrection. They relied on the living voice, the living testimony. And Alexander and Rufus would be part of that living testimony. You know, Simon of Cyrene was still in Jerusalem 3 days later, you know? Okay. Probably a month later to have Pesach Sheni.
What's the probability of finding Alexander from Cyrene in a...
What's that?
What would be the probability of finding Alexander Cyrene's box in a Jewish...
Not great.
No.
Not great. It's a very cool thing. Yeah, it's a very cool thing. Those bone boxes, those ossuaries, have a lot of great information about the first century just from the inscriptions. Not the least of which is James, the brother of Jesus and his bone box. Okay, we're way off track, and look at how many of these we got to go.
What was the point that Asher Naron was attempting to make with the who carried the cross thing?
He's trying to say that one gospel says Jesus and one gospel says Simon the son of Cyrene, and so it's a contradiction. We're saying Christian tradition says it's not a contradiction, that both carried, that Jesus carried at a certain distance, stumbled, then the Romans conscripted Simon of Cyrene. Number four, did one thief repent? According to Luke, yes. According to Mark and Matthew, no. We won't give him this one because Mark and Matthew don't say that the other thief never repented. Luke's narrative perhaps just adds more detail. He had more of the story. Last words. We find his last words on the cross. We find different answers for the last words. In John 19:30, his last words were, "It is finished." Mark 15:34, his last words were, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Luke 23:46, his last words were, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." All right. So, different accounts of the last words. This is what the different gospels say. I personally don't see this as a big problem. I think this is, I like to think that he said all these words. And there's actually seven phrases that the master utters from the cross. Seven different phrases. I did a sermon once called the seven utterances, where we went through all seven of the different words. It was a Passover sermon. Okay, number six. How many days and nights? Well, this is going to depend on a couple things. This is going to depend on whether it was Nisan 14 or Nisan 15. And it's going to depend on if you accept Preparation Day as Preparation Day for the weekly Sabbath or Preparation Day for a festival Sabbath. And then that would depend on whether or not you think that the Sabbath of Unleavened Bread fell on a Saturday that year, or perhaps it fell on a Friday that year, both of which are possibilities. So it's really, really, really difficult. Let's put it this way. It's pretty much impossible between the synoptics and John to come up with a clear and certain reckoning of the days and nights in the tomb. Now, those of you who have been with me as I've taught on this, you know that I do create a reconstruction of this. My reconstruction, the thumbnail sketch, is based on the concept of an early Seder. And I've often in the taught an early Seder, a Good Thursday crucifixion, and that would give you Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 3 days at least. And so you're closer to that text that we saw back in Matthew. Do you remember this? Matthew 12:40, Son of Man in the tomb, 3 days, 3 nights. We already studied this several lessons ago. However, we learned that that's a textual variant in that it didn't appear in the Hebrew Gospel and it's not attested to in Luke. It's going to be 3 days and three nights. Instead, every other text says on the third day, on the third day, on the third day. Every other consistent text in the New Testament says he rose on the third day, not on the fourth day. And if you have 3 days and three nights, you end up with him rising on the fourth day. Number eight, was the stone rolled away when the women arrived? Yes, all the Gospels say it was, but the one I just read in Matthew 28 makes it sound like it wasn't. How many approached the tomb? This is really entertaining. John 20, it's just Mary Magdalene, right? We already saw it. We already saw the text. Mark 16, however, has two Marys and Salome. Luke 24:10 has two Marys, Joanna, and others, unidentified others. Whereas Matthew 28, which we just read, has two Marys. Okay, number 10. By whom were they greeted? John 20, we saw Mary arrived there. She wasn't greeted by anyone. Mark 16:5 reports that the women went into the tomb and they found one man sitting there and he startled them and said, "Don't be afraid." Luke 24:4, however, the women go into the tomb and they find two men. It's doubled. And Matthew 28:2 has an angel sitting on the stone outside the tomb. All right, so that's kind of confusing. How many angels? Above. What did the angels say? Okay, this is interesting. The angels have a pretty consistent message in the synoptics. All right, here's what the angel says in Mark 16. Be not amazed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, which has been crucified. He is risen. He is not here. Behold the place where they laid him. Go tell his disciples and Peter. He goes before you into Galilee, and there you shall see him as he said unto you. They went out and they fled. Okay, that's Mark. Matthew is very similar. Fear not. You're seeking Jesus. He's not here. Go quickly, tell his disciples. He's risen. He goes ahead of you into Galilee. There you shall see him. Luke has a different message. And in Luke, there's two angels. So in Luke, why do you seek the living among the dead? He's not here, he is risen. Remember how he spoke to you when he was yet in Galilee, saying the Son of Man must be delivered up to the hands of sinful men, crucified, and rise on the third day. And they remembered his words. So Luke has a different message altogether. And John, it's not even the same women, or it's Mary Magdalene alone, right, in John. She doesn't see any angels until Peter and John come and check it out. They look inside. They don't see any angels. They see the tomb's empty. They leave. Then she looks in verse 12, and she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and one at the feet. And they said, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she said to them, "Because they have taken away the Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." And that's all they said to her. "Woman, why are you weeping?" Mm-hmm. All right, so different messages. Okay? Did he tell them that he was going to meet them, the disciples to meet him in Galilee? In a couple of the messages he did, and in the other two he didn't. The angels didn't. Number 14, where and to whom did the risen Jesus reveal himself? Well, in one account to Mary here at the tomb, and in another account to the two on the road to Emmaus, and in another account he appeared in the midst of the 12. Not discrepancies, by the way, that one's just... Number 15, did Mary receive word from an angel before encountering Jesus? This is all just the same. This is the same set of texts. According to John, I think he's wrong here because she did. She did in John here. We just read that. Number 17. So some of this gets really lame. What was Mary's state of mind when Jesus appeared to her? Grief in John, but joy in Matthew.
Right,
exactly. So yeah. Number 18. What is the reaction of the women? This is interesting, because Mark, the reaction of the women, listen to this. This is from Mark 16:8. The reaction of the women, after the angels say this to them, it just says, Mark 16:8, and they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had come upon them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. They said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the kicker. That's where the Gospel of Mark ends. That's it. You never see the risen Messiah in Mark. So there's additional endings that are added to Mark. And in manuscript collections, we have three different additional endings for Mark, because that's such an unsatisfactory ending. That, you have later scribes collecting and saying, well, you got to like put more of the story. And so you have endings from that are kind of gleaned from the other Gospels tacked on there in some cases. Scholars debate about this all the time. Is that where Mark was supposed to end? Or did we lose the last leaf of Mark? Yeah.
The last leaf of Mark. Continued.
Anyway, so we get the point is, we get more of the story in the rest of the Gospels. And it contradicts Mark's ending. In that Mark ends just with them afraid and telling no one. As if that's really the intended end of Mark, as if nobody ever found out about this. You know, it's just not, just on a literary level, it doesn't work. It's just like, okay. Okay, so...
it was Paul Harvey.
Yeah, it's like, how would we know? Yeah, that's one of those endings. Every one of your Gospels of Mark will have additional sentences and paragraphs, but those come from various manuscript traditions, and nobody knows what the original was. And some of the Mark manuscripts just end with 8. Oh no, Mary gives different reports in John 20:18. Mary Magdalene came announcing to the disciples, I've seen the Lord, and that he said these things to her. But in Luke 24:9, what does she say? Luke 24:9, it says, they returned from the tomb and reported all these things to the 11 and to the rest. That's not different. I missed the discrepancy there. I don't see it. Maybe I'm not understanding his argument. Number 21, how many were present at his appearance? In one account, it says the 11. But in John, it says Thomas was not with them. So 11 minus 1 is 10. And in another account, it says the 12. All right, so which is it? These are just different ways of referring to the group of the disciples. Mm-hmm. The 12, the 11. I mean, you don't need everyone in the 12 to be the 12, actually. Right, because Judas is already dead. But and that's why. That's really irrelevant. How many times did he appear? This is also irrelevant. He goes through the various Gospels and pulls out 4 times, 3 times, 2 times, 2 times, 6 times from Corinthians, 6 times. It tells us that in the beginning of Acts that he appeared numerous times in many ways over a period of 40 days.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So that's also not a discrepancy.
And other people.
Right. It's just these are the times reported by the Gospel writer.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. Where did he appear? In Luke says in Jerusalem, but Matthew has him in Galilee, appearing in Galilee. John also has him in Galilee. So again, 40 days in various places. permitted to touch. John 20:17, don't touch me, I have not yet ascended to the Father. In the other Gospels, yeah, but there's another passage that has the women touching him. They grasp his feet.
In this,
yes, that's in John, and that's Mary Magdalene in John 20:17. But in another passage, the women actually do touch his feet. It's Matthew 28:9, and behold, Jesus met them and greeted them, and they came up and took hold of his feet. Right there. So there seems to be a discrepancy. He tells Mary not to touch him, and then
that was at the tomb.
Mary, yeah, at the tomb, he told me.
This is not
at the tomb. Anyway, so I would say that even if it is a don't touch me thing, completely, like don't touch me instead of don't cling to me, and that's a question. If it's a don't touch me thing, because I have not yet ascended to the Father, there is a some sort of distance between the events, some sort of mystical thing happened. But I think perhaps it should be understood just as don't cling to me. Okay, last one, number 25. The receiving of the Holy Spirit. John 20:22, he breathes on his disciples and he says, receive ye the Holy Spirit. And then, but in Acts, it happens at Pentecost. All right. It's not a discrepancy. He says, receive the Holy Spirit. He blows on them. They receive the Holy Spirit at Shavuot. It's not a problem. Okay, so now you've got 25, that's all 25. And now several of them I just passed over quickly. I would like to suggest, if I could, just very quickly give you from off the top of my head as I remember it, and I've got this worked out in Torah Club 4 in some detail, a harmonization. All right? I'm suggesting that here's how things really went down, based on all four Gospels, that a group of all these women, in fact, set out for the tomb together. They did not set out Saturday night. Saturday night, they bought the spices and prepared the things that they needed and that sort of thing. They missed the whole guards, angel coming down, all that sort of thing. They didn't see that. Instead, that happened, as Matthew reports, it had already happened when they arrived. But it happened at Havdalah time, Saturday night. It happened Saturday night. The guards shook with fear. They took off. The tomb is left standing empty. They go report, hey, the tomb is empty. We don't know what happened. They're in a lot of trouble. So the angel that sat on the stone on the outside was Saturday night. By Sunday morning, the women are coming with the spices they prepared. All the women are coming. They come, and what do they see? The tomb is empty. They don't see an angel on the outside. They don't see that the tomb is empty. They see the tomb is open. As soon as they see the tomb is open, Mary suspects foul play, Mary Magdalene. She heads back to tell the other disciples. She leaves the group of women there. The group of women go in. They encounter the angel.
One at a time.
You have two different messages and two different angels. Okay, so there's two angels in there. They see the one. He delivers his message. The second delivers his message. They are excited, happy, go running to report to the disciples. Meanwhile, Mary is on her way back following Peter and John. Peter and John arrive at the tomb, go in. They don't see any angels. They don't see anything. They leave. Then Mary is left standing outside there alone. She has not encountered the rest of this group of women. She goes in, sees the two angels, comes out, sees the master. Peter and John are already gone. Then she goes back to make her report. So you can actually, this is actually a very reasonable harmonization of all of these details. And it's really easy to see how each one, as they're reporting the story, as they heard it from so-and-so, that these things actually could pretty seamlessly work together, and in this case without doing any violence really to the text. Okay, so what am I giving him? I'm giving him number one, on which day was Jesus crucified? And the rest I'm not giving him. I'll give him 1 out of 25.
I have a recollection that Josephus wrote something about at least the stories around Jesus.
No. Oh, yes. That's another deal. Josephus does talk about the master, yes. there's a problem with the Josephus text. Yes, the Josephus text, there, it just goes a little too far. The Josephus text goes a little too far and reports the whole resurrection and that, you know, he is the Messiah of Israel, and then moves on with the rest of the Josephus narrative, making it sound like Josephus is a believer, mm-hmm. which he's not. And so it's really clear that the Josephus text has been monkeyed with, that a Christian scribe has monkeyed with it. However, recently, I'd say in the last 100 years, scholars said, you know what, it's been monkeyed with, but there's something authentic here. He must have really spoken about the master. He really did say something. And I think we can figure out what he really did say. And just took away some of the conclusions from the text and recreated a theoretical text of Josephus, of what he really did say about the master. And subsequent to that reconstruction, a copy of Josephus has been found that confirms the reconstruction.
Wow.
Yeah.
How recent? Like 50 years ago?
Yeah, this is within the last century. Yep. Yeah, it is cool. It's a fabulous and it's a fabulous find and speaks. I mean, we are in the information age. And as long as I'm on the information age point, let me just tell you why it's important that we're completely honest with this stuff. And why? Because in the past, in years past, Christianity has been able to survive on dogma and to just say, this is what it is. Boom. But in the information age, that doesn't work. Wikipedia is there for everyone. You know, click, click, you know, and you're in to more information than you could have possibly dreamed of in the past. So we can't play the dogma game anymore, and we have to be honest about where we have weaknesses and discrepancies, as well as where we have strengths. Otherwise, we lose credibility. All right, so that's how I would harmonize these things. I had one more thing I was going to do with you tonight, and that, well, first of all, there's where it says the multiple witnesses response. Asher Norman does a nice job of pointing out why that's not really a good answer. So ordinarily, Christian apologists reply, and they say, well, it's normal when you have witnesses, reporting an event to give different versions of the story, and that's how you know it's true. Asher Norman says, well, from a legal perspective, that's how you know it's not true, you know, when there's different versions. So he does a good, I thought that was a fair criticism. However, I didn't feel like, on the other hand, I felt like most of the discrepancies he cited were not actual discrepancies. So, in any case.
No eyewitness accounts would be identical, or you'd have a problem.
Oh, yes, and that is for certain. If they were all identical,
you'd have a problem.
Then we would say, there's been foul play in the text here as it's been passed on to us. Yep. Just like that Josephus. You can read that Josephus passage about the master and say, this smells fishy. Some doubted. He points out, even after the resurrection, some of his disciples doubted. And that's reported in John 20, and it's reported in Matthew 28. That's credibility. That adds credibility. I would be one of those doubters. Even after I'd be like, well, I think I did see him. I was there. Yeah, I was there. But, you know, really? You know, I mean, you know, was this just some sort of mass hysteria we all had or something? You know, for sure. Of course he would doubt. How would you not doubt this? Anyway, Matthew 27:50 has a really curious text. Matthew 27:50. At the time of the crucifixion, it says in verse 51, the veil of the temple is torn, the earth shook, the rock split, tombs were opened, and many bodies of the saints Now, who are these saints who would already be dead? The saints. This is actually really interesting. The Greek word that we translate as saints here, it corresponds to the Hebrew chasidim. So yes, many of the chasidim, you didn't know there were guys with black hats and black coats and long pants. Devout ones. Chasidim means devout ones. Many of the chasidim who had fallen asleep were raised, and coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many. This is the most curious little text. It doesn't appear in any of the other Gospels. And Asher Norman points out, wait a second, that's just bizarre. That is just bizarre.
They would have been recognizable then.
Yeah, they'd be recognizable. And not only that, but many people saw them, and you would have some record of this. Somebody would have like recorded this somewhere. He says that there were dead people that came back to life. I mean, this is pretty big. But you know, Matthew gives it two verses, never mentions these people again or tells us what happened to them after that. And it's a really strange text. It's a really strange text. There is another possibility. Chasidim refers to not just any devout person, but in Talmudic literature, in the days of the Master, it referred to a certain sect. It was like a holy man. A chassid was a holy man, like you would think of a miracle worker, a wonder-working guy. So there were these chassidim of the Galilee. And there's even books. There's a book called The Galilean Jewishness of Jesus, or something like that, that talks about how he fits into this class of these chassidim, wonder-working guys. So the most famous of all chassidim is a guy named Honi the Circle Drawer. Why is he called the Circle Drawer? Because one time during a drought, he drew a circle on the ground, and he went and sat down in the circle, and he said, Father in heaven, which was also a mark of the chassidim, that they referred to God as Father. Father in heaven, until you provide rain, I'm not going to step out of this circle. So he kind of had a tantrum. And the head of the Sanhedrin sent him a message after he heard about this and how he had brought rain through this. He said, you know, if you weren't Honi the Circle Drawer, I'd have you excommunicated for that kind of disrespectful blackmailing of God. But since you're Honi, what can I say? He treats you like a son. So Honi lived a generation before the Master. So he lived, say, back in about 70 B.C., 70 to 50 B.C., somewhere in there. There's a really interesting story about Honi. Listen to this. This is from the Talmud. Rabbi Yochanan said about Honi, is it possible for anyone to sleep for 70 years with one? One day he was going on the road, Honi was going on the road, and he saw a certain man planting a carob tree. Honi said to him, how many years does it take for this carob tree to bear fruit? He said, 70 years. Honi said to him, is it clear to you that you will live another 70 years? The man told Honi, this man found a world containing carob trees, just as my ancestors planted carob trees for me, so too I plant them for my children. So he said, I'm leaving them for the next generation. Honi sat down and ate bread. Drowsiness overcame him. He fell asleep. An outcropping of rock rose round him, and he became hidden from sight and slept for 70 years. When he rose, he saw that man picking fruit from the carob tree. Honi said, are you the man who planted this tree? He said, no, I am his grandson. Honi said to him, it is evident that I have slept for 70 years. He saw that his mare had given birth to generations of offspring. He went to his house. He said to the members of his household, is the son of Honi the circle maker still alive? They answered him, his son is not alive. His grandson is alive. He said to them, I am Honi the circle maker. They did not believe him. He went to the house of study. He heard the rabbi saying, our teachings are clear to us as they were in the years of Honi the circle maker. For whenever he would come to the house of study, whatever difficulties the rabbis had, he would resolve them. Honi said to them, I am Honi the circle maker. They did not believe him. They did not accord him the honor due him. He became distressed and prayed for divine mercy and died.
Rip Van Winkle.
Yeah, it's the Jewish Rip Van Winkle. But this, here's the deal. This could be one of those guys. He fell asleep. Rocks came over him. That's, you know, being buried in a tomb. You know, that could be like being laid in a tomb. He wakes up. He comes to life. He comes out. It's like generations have passed. People don't recognize him. So Asher Norman says, if something like that really happened, there'd be some record of it. Well, in the Talmud, there is some record of something like that happening. Okay. So this is it for reason number 22. The conclusion that he draws is that virtually every detail of the resurrection accounts in each gospel is directly contradicted by at least one other gospel. Why should any Jew put their soul at risk based upon reports that are inconsistent and contradictory? And he cites 1 Corinthians 15:17, where Paul says, if Christ is not raised, we are to be pitied above all men. And I would answer his question on the basis of 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul cites how many Jews did believe in the days of the Master, and he says he appeared to James, he appeared to Peter, then he appeared to the 12, and he appeared to many more. And then he says, and he appeared last of all to me as one abnormally born. But he says, and he appeared to over 500 at one time, most of which, he says, are still alive to this day. Meaning, if you have a question about this, go and ask them. You can go, you could, in Paul's day when he was writing Corinthians, you could travel to Jerusalem and find the original community of disciples, including James, the brother of the Master, including the 12, including these 500, and say, tell me the story here. Yeah, and so there, that was the early believers did not base their belief in the resurrection on the testimony of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They based their belief in the resurrection on the living voice, the abiding voice, the testimony of the eyewitnesses. Okay, so reason 22, and have a happy Passover.